It's time for Intersections, where art and science meet, your weekly hour of conversation, where you learn about curious ideas, creative works, and interesting phenomena with your host, Mark Kiesling, the founder of the Da Vinci Pursuit, and Krista Hoffman-Longton, Assistant Dean for Faculty Affairs and Professional Development at the Indiana University School of Medicine. Now, it's time for Intersections, where art and science meet.
I'm Mark Kiesling, the founder of the Da Vinci Pursuit, where we create a museum without walls so artists, scientists, and the community can create unique interactions and conversation. And in today's conversation, we're going to be talking about the art in the technology of professional photo retouching. And this is the key to our guest's success. And she focuses on what matters most to clients, knows how to fix those issues quickly. And so what's really great is I love, and we'll get into that in a little bit, but I love the phrase that she's coined, which is, it's not the wand, it's the wizard, which is so great. And Krista?
Welcome, everyone. I'm Dr. Krista Longton. I'm an Associate Professor of Communication Studies at IUPUI and an Assistant Dean for Faculty Affairs and Professional Development at the Indiana University School of Medicine. So with us today is our guest, Lisa Carney. As Mark mentioned, she's a professional photographer, retoucher, and educator. Lisa, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you very, very much for having me. This is going to be a hoot.
So one of the places I want to get started is if you could just like begin by just defining what a retoucher is for us, I think, and for our listeners, I think that might be a great spot.
Interesting. All right. Well, I will tell you that there's different people call retouchers or the process of what I do different things. So there's a photo retoucher is often someone who just cleans up a photo. A finisher or compositor is someone who puts together photos. So I'm actually a finisher, but that's such a kind of a boutique word that folks don't even know that that exists. So I've been a movie poster designer and finisher for, oh my God, like 30 years. And so I'm actually more of a compositor, I would say. However, I think your lay people would consider that a retoucher. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. Thank you so much. Mark, do you want to take the next question?
Yeah. So when you think about compositing, what is that?
Yeah, well, I do work in Hollywood. So inevitably what that means is you'll sometimes get actors who don't want to do the pose that you have for the movie poster. And so I have to take their head from a shot that they did somewhere else and put it on someone else's body, which is fascinating. Or it's as simple as you know, the actor's eyes are closed in one headshot and we need another shot. More often than not, I am stripping people's heads onto other people's bodies. So
that's really amazing. So I'm of a generation old enough that I, in high school on my yearbook, did that same kind of work, but I did it with a brush on a negative.
You and me both, my friend. Yes. Yes. I started doing the same
amazing.
Way.
Amazing. Yes. I started doing that a long time ago. Like if somebody, you know, back then you had to all conform. So if you didn't wear a tie, I had to paint in a tie. If you had an eye that was in the shadow because they screwed up taking the picture, you know, I had to paint the eye in to match the other eye. But you're working at a scale. It's so tiny.
It's tiny. Well, and I'm sure you're familiar with Jerry Elsman, who just passed, unfortunately, I think 2 weeks ago, who was one of the initial, like what you would call Photoshop compositors, only he did it with negatives in the darkroom. It was well before Photoshop, and he was amazing and actually a huge inspiration for me while I was going through art school, going through photography school with Jerry Elsman. I just thank God the computer came along and I was like, oh, fantastic. This will be easier.
What is it about his work that was so inspirational for you, Lisa?
That's a great question. I would say it was so magical. So I will tell you, I'm a frustrated illustrator or painter. Like I really wanted to be a painter and an illustrator when I started out, but I'm a lousy renderer. Like I just couldn't draw. And Jerry Elsman was able to create these fantastic compositions with photography, and I could shoot a picture. So I didn't have to draw a castle or draw a hand. I just needed to get a photograph of a hand or a castle or a frog or whatever you're doing. So that's what drew me to the fantasy imagery he could make without having to be a good drawer.
It makes sense too, because when I think about even the work that I do, you know, the research that I do, or the, you know, broader speaking, the work I do with students, like I have strengths that I want to amplify and sort of limitations that I want to minimize. And, you know, I'm not good at every single part of my job. And so figuring out kind of what are the things that we need to be successful and how can we spend the most time doing those things? That makes sense to me.
Yeah. And you know, what's beautiful about what you just said is that for me, I wanted to be an illustrator, quote unquote, or painter. And I am a image illustrator, only I just don't have to do it with a paintbrush or a piece or a pencil. And like being able to navigate into a technology to get my results and not worry about my lack of skill in a different area, if that makes sense.
Oh yeah. And that, you know, that's one of the things we wanted to talk about today. Technology has changed your life.
Oh my heavens.
So many ways.
Yes. And continues to do so.
Yeah. It's evolving so fast. So I ran across you, Lisa, because I took a course online with Kelby One, which was so great on iPhone photography. And in there, you talked just briefly about this part of your life. But I was blown away because it is so much beyond the technology. And you kept saying throughout the course, and I just loved it, that don't focus on the technology. Whatever you have, you can make it work, but it is really the eye. It's that artist in you, right? Am I getting that correct?
100%. Well, and I'll tell you, I'm the world of photographers, we tend to be gearheads. My degree is in photography. And when I say gearheads, I mean, we as a community mistake the gear for our talent. So if you're in a Facebook photo group, for example, everybody posts what lens they use, what f-stop they use, what ISO. And I'm like, who cares? What's the story you're telling? You are not your gear. You are not your camera. And so, as I said, I have a degree in photography from Art Center College of Design. And I was a 4x5 film shooter, like 4x5, hand processing my own film. And a 4x5 camera is as rudimentary as you can possibly get. Like, you really need to know your science, if you will, when you're exposing. And I have switched completely to mobile photography. I use an iPhone now. And I hear all these people being derisive about, use your real camera. And I'm like, the camera is me. The device I'm taking it with is secondary.
This is one of the things that I spend a lot of time talking about with students, right? In part because when I think about my students, I know that I am trying to train them for not the job they're going to get right when they're done, but the job three jobs down, right? And the technology is going to change. So I can train you on which button to push. I can train you on, but aesthetics doesn't change. I mean, to some extent it does, right? But really sort of how to tell a good story, right? You know, everybody's still reading Joseph Campbell. And so when we think about kind of what are the things that we really want, out of art, I think that the science piece, as you said, Lisa, like, yes, you need to be a scientist, but what you need to be a scientist about is your craft, not necessarily, again, which button to push or which gear that you need. So can you talk a little bit about how your craft plays out, like when you are approaching a project or approaching an image?
Yeah. And oh, I'm so glad we're talking about this, because I think this is critical now versus, like, if you and I were having this conversation 25 years ago, this would be a completely different conversation, because the technology was not changing so rapidly. You know, it was, how do you expose film? How do you develop film? And, or even when Photoshop was first starting out, for example, it was pretty much the same thing. Good heavens, in 6 months, some of the stuff I'm using now will be obsolete and there'll be something new. So what I find we need to be is flexible, not attached to an application or a particular phone, for example, for me, camera, or a particular lens, because with the computer process, and I'm sorry, I'm talking about these things so interchangeably, because to me they are, the smartphone and the laptop and a tablet and a desktop computer are one and the same for me. They're really just extensions of themselves to me. And I can't get attached to a certain filter in Photoshop, because in 3 upgrades, that won't work anymore, because Apple computers have changed the processing chip and now that filter doesn't work. So it's a weird creative model to have to follow now, that you cannot rely on the technology you learned 5 years ago or even 1 year ago necessarily. You have to be flexible.
I love that whole idea though, Lisa, of that when you step out, it's almost like you step out of the clothes that made you Clark Kent, right?
Yeah.
And you kind of step out away from that, those skills and all that, that you're kind of cloaked in as the everyday person. And then you get to be transformed in a way into this superhero who does look at way beyond what the limitations are that could be there. And so it has to be freeing. I know, frustrating sometimes, but I would think it has to be freeing for you.
I literally just wrote that word down right now while you were talking. It was freedom. It frees us up if we allow it to. So for folks who are just getting started or entering this, you're not bogged down by it. You will never be an expert at this. I am not an expert at Photoshop. I've been using it probably 7 days a week for the last 30 years, and I would never call myself an expert at it because it changes so rapidly. And isn't that amazing? And isn't that freeing? Because now you could start. You have no reason to not start and not put yourself out there. And I couch this a lot. It's my art is my business. It is my work. So I'm speaking about this in a professional manner and as an artist, because again, that for me, they're one and the same. So yeah, it's very freeing and terrifying all at the same time, because you can't rely on that crutch of, oh, I've been using this for 20 years. Of course, I know what I'm doing.
So one of the things I think, Lisa, that's interesting to me to hear you talk is to talk about the relationship between what you see as art and what you see as business, and, you know, kind of seeing how those things really dovetail for you, right? That artistic process is really fundamental to your ability to, you know, make a living and your ability to kind of keep your career going. So can you talk a little bit about how you sort of approach thinking about your art as something that is also fundamentally important to your livelihood?
It's really interesting. I'm trying to think how I would answer that. I will tell you what I had done when I got out of school. So as I said, I went to Art Center, graduated a gazillion dollars when I got out of school. And I realized that my photography was really an extension of my relationship with people. So I was an editorial portrait shooter, and I like to shoot people the way they felt to me, not necessarily how they wanted to be presented, especially if you can imagine in the Hollywood community, a lot of actors, actresses, or just people in general. You know, if someone wanted to appear strong and forefoot, you know, a big CEO, and I really saw them as dark and dangerous and corrupted. this really happened for me. This is really a fascinating thing. And I realized part of my soul was dying every time I had to photograph someone in a way that they did not feel to me. You know, I'm very empathetic in my work, like feeling other people. So I pivoted hard left, and I shifted to doing movie poster work because I happen to be really good at Photoshop. And while the skill set is very similar, my soul is not involved. So I can do commercial work, provide a service for a client, and make a great living. I mean, I've done very well by myself, and I've enjoyed a really great lifestyle. And I still do work on the side. And I still use those same Photoshop tools and tips and eye photography in my personal work as I do in my professional work. I just do different subject matter. I hope that answers your question.
No, I think it really does. And I think that, you know, when I think about the work that Mark and I do, bringing scientists and artists together, part of what we want folks to think about is sort of that creative process that lives in our work that we do every day, that our job, right, that we don't always talk about, and how to kind of amplify that. You know, how do we find spaces to give our scientists an opportunity to talk about what makes them creative? And how do we give our artists an opportunity to say, this is the science of my work. This is the science of how I do glass blowing, or pick another, you know, artistic endeavor. And so I think one of the things that to me undergirds what you're saying is the idea that there are places where it is helpful to sort of bring your whole self to your work. And there are places where it's helpful to say, I understand I have a goal and I'm using my skills to meet that goal.
100%. That ability to compartmentalize, perhaps we'd say a bit about that, because especially for me, when I'm an older female and I'm doing retouching and there's body issues for women, and I have to make a decision about, well, what am I providing here, or doing advertising work. So when I do advertising retouching, you're selling a product, you're not selling the model. So if I'm retouching a model, is that offensive? And it's like, well, wait a minute, I'm not selling her, I'm selling the sweater she is wearing. And it's an interesting line to have to balance and cross. And yeah, I would agree with you. Like, scientists and mathematicians and doctors are so creative in their problem-solving technique. And artists like me have to be technical at times. It's really interesting. It's that we merge into each other's lane, I would say.
You know, the idea of that merging into each other's lane, how true is that? I mean, it's that you really have to let go of one of the things that you think that you were trained predominantly in to get to the other one, right?
100%. I will tell you, do you know, for my free time, I don't know if this is a bit of a non sequitur, but I spend my time watching art history documentaries and listening to neuroscience podcasts. That's what I do. Isn't that weird? But that's, I'm like, oh, how does my brain work? Oh, that's so interesting. Oh, no wonder I was struggling on that job because of X, Y, or Z. Yeah.
That's not strange.
I don't think it is either. I think that's homework, and I probably should suspend. I actually had a really good conversation with my colleagues this week about a recent episode of Nova that was about the science and to some extent the social issues associated with like direct-to-consumer DNA testing. And one of the things that we were talking about, right, again, you know, my training as a communication scholar, as a researcher, and to some extent as an artist, brings me to this space of, you know, we have this technology, but are we thinking about how this technology shapes the way that we interact with one another? Are we thinking about the ethics, how we build empathy, how we build trust? And there was a researcher in particular in this NOVA episode who was looking at some of the disparities in data, particularly in communities of color that exist among, you know, 23andMe and other, I don't want to disparage that one company, but any company that you can, you know, get a recent DNA test from, and how little data they have on people of color from around the world, and how that shapes all different kinds of things, whether we're talking about my relationship with race as a white woman or a person of color's relationship with race, and how we talk about those things. And I think that when I think about your work and I think about some of the ethics of that work, right, that's one of those places where we do need both our artistic training and our scientific training to be able to answer the tough questions, right? One of my colleagues who is a really talented oncologist says over and over again, no one is going to cure cancer in a room by themselves. That they're going to need artists and community members and nurses and doctors and, you know, pick a profession to be able to do this really well. And so I think if we're thinking about solving problems, or in your case, selling a product, we have to think creatively about what are the tools that we have to do that well.
Yeah. And in asking those questions, like I will tell you, when I was it was a few years ago when I was in art school, I was one of the few women in the photography department. There weren't any women in the photography department at the time. And then in my industry now, there's very few people of color in the artistic division of it. They're in the production side of it, but not the artistic. And we have to acknowledge that and say, and how can we amplify other people? Wait a minute, you have to be conscious of it in the first place. Or even when I'm portraying and I'm doing artwork, I push back. Like, I had a really great opportunity to do a Speedo catalog years ago. And initially, at the time when the assignment was given to me, they had all Olympic athletes, right? Completely over retouched, like muscles flattened down because they're not considered, you know, in fashion photography, you step on that, we call that, and you overpaint them. And I remember talking to the creative director and I said, hey, who's your audience? It's athletes, right? Well, those athletes work really hard to get those things. Can we leave those? Can we not paint their bodies to make them look like supermodels? And he was like, yeah, maybe. Why don't we try that? And I'm like, yes, why don't we try that? Yeah, so there's opportunities, I think, to ask different questions. You just need to be aware.
That inquisitiveness that you're talking about, I mean, that's at the heart of what you do. And you really are, you're looking, somebody gives you an assignment, but you're really looking at that through that eye of what questions do I have about this that helps you then be able to do your retouching or to do.
Yeah. Yeah. It's what am I saying? What are we as a collective who are producing whatever product we're producing? If we're talking about my work, my commercial work, what are we trying to say here? So I will often not monochromize. What's the word I want to use? African-American skin often gets made into a monochromatic tonal value in advertising. It's like, no, we don't need to do this. And I take my job really seriously to push back and not do those kind of things. Again, a little bit of a non sequitur there, but it is about asking questions and asking about, can we not over retouch this? And there was a job I did. Do I want to say who this is? No, I'm not going to say who it is. Older actress. And I mean, older actress. And the advertising that was out there, they made her look 35. And I was like, no, I'm not doing that. Happy to work on this job, but I'm not making her look 35. She's 75. Not doing it. Anyway, I don't know why I spouted that, but there you go.
Well, that's important because what you're talking about, and that's what Krista was saying as well, there's also ethics involved in this. Yeah. And so a lot of people don't think, oh, you're just a hack for something, or you're doing an illustration for somebody, or you're doing a retouch for somebody. But there's more to it than that. You have an ethical center that drives your work.
And I'm going to tell you, it's challenging. I gave a Photoshop lesson. This is probably about 15 years ago. I was in Italy and I was giving a Photoshop demo and showing my work. And we were talking about body image and issues like that. And this gal, young gal, she was in her 20s. She said, abbracciate. You know, it's your arm. It's your hand that's doing this. She was calling me out. And I was like, damn, she's right. Yeah. I need to rethink how I'm doing this in my life and where can I push back and affect change as opposed to just pulling out and not doing it. Yeah. It was pretty interesting.
I think that's one of the interesting parts too, that when I work with both scientists and artists, I often try to find what are the values that we share, where are the Venn diagram, if you will, of overlap between two communities of people. And I do think that is one of those spaces that is a shared opportunity for conversation around having to make decisions and having to like ask yourself hard questions about what your values are, and then being able to figure out how to live those in your day-to-day work. Yeah. So I know that, you know, I have a sense of kind of what your work looks like, and I have a sense of I think a little bit more of a sense of kind of what that looks like in terms of the product of your work. Could you talk a little bit more about the process of your work? So you get I don't know if you call it a commission, you get a job, right? You have a task to complete. So what's the process that you use to get the information that you need from your client to be able to kind of carry out your work in the way that best meets their needs?
Awesome. So if we're talking about retouching work in particular, like movie posters, streaming, that kind of work, I will tell you, I have honed a very linear workflow. And what I mean by that is I literally have these sheets with questions because there's size and dimension issues. So it used to be in the old days, it was really easy. You did an 8x10 poster, you know, a 27x40 inch movie poster and a billboard. That was it. Well, with streaming, now you have up to like 37 different board sizes, because everything, you know, you're on Netflix or Amazon Prime Video or Hulu or whomever, Disney streaming. And are you on your phone? Wait, what kind of phone are you on? Are you on a fat phone? Or are you a skinny phone? Are you on a tablet? Are you on an iPad? Are you on a TV? Are you on a smart TV? Because you have all those windows, and each one of those, they call them products, the window screens that you have. So I have to be very linear to ask for what they need, what color spaces are they working in, where's the destination of the file. And then from there, I back my way into the job and then build the job out the way it needs to be built. Now that's different than a design job. However, because I'm a finisher at the end, when I design for the complete 37 products, like the big scale. People who are just designers often just design for the movie poster. And then we have to figure out the rest later.
And that's because you know what's coming.
I know the pain of what's coming. You're right. Because it's exactly. painful, right?
If I don't do that. Yeah, it's painful.
Yeah, because by the time the job gets to me, there is no time and it's everything's on fire and hurry up and
I love that, that whole idea. We've been talking with Lisa Carney, who's a professional photographer and retoucher. Please join us for more conversation after this short break.
This is Dave Baghdad, host of The Kitchen Party Kaylee. I hope you'll join me every Sunday at 10 p.m. for the best music from Ireland, Scotland, Canada, and the U.S. The Kitchen Party Kaylee, Celtic music from across the globe and across town.
Welcome back. I'm Krista Longton, and today we're having a conversation with Lisa Carney about her approach to the post-photographic process, making her unique among artists who employ and work with technology.
And when, right before the break, we were talking a little bit with you, Lisa, about the idea of you get something after somebody else has had it, and they may not be giving you all the different formats you have for it and all that. So you went back and you were talking about the design process. And in a way, you were, even though you were making it for multiple things, you had an eye towards that. You were really simplifying that process so that down the road, it made a big difference in terms of that. Can you talk more about how you use simplification in that way?
Yeah, it's really, I would say for me, that's a hallmark of my career and is what has allowed me actually to excel in my career is my, I'm not sure I want to say ability, but necessity. Like I needed to do this for my own brain. I'm very ADD. And if things get too far in the weeds, I can get in trouble very quickly. So I needed just as self-survival to simplify things. I do it in my photography work and I also do it in Photoshop. And I find, especially, I don't know if y'all use Photoshop or those kind of newer technology art, geez, you could get overwhelmed. You can get so overwhelmed. And the idea, and I think people think they need to know everything. You don't. You can keep it so simple. So for me, it's about having a roadmap. Like, where do I want to get to? What's the destination? All right. And I think of it quite literally as a roadmap. What's the fastest route to that destination? And don't get off on these tangents. That can be creatively very dangerous because I'm not designing these pieces for the most part. I do some design work, but the bulk of my industry is finishing and reimagining this artwork. So I don't want to be going off into another tangent visually.
Right. And I, you know, you were just talking about the part of you that's an educator as well, because when you teach other people how to do some of this, I noticed from having watched you, teach me was this idea that you trying to keep us from getting too far down in there.
Yeah. Or thinking that you have to.
Right. Yeah. Where we lose the creativity or we lose the inspiration for why we did it to begin with.
Yeah. Well, I will tell you, and I'm really glad you just mentioned that when you are on a photo group and they're asking you what f-stop you used and what lens you used, you're already on the wrong, that's the wrong conversation because it doesn't matter. So if you're into storytelling and I want to talk, I have an art show coming up on grief. Great. How would I express grief? What color does grief look like to me? What's the subject matter of grief? Okay. I have a picture. I want them to read the subject. Oh, that background better not be too detailed or they won't get into the subject. Those are the kind of visual conversations you need to have. Not wait, how do you use the calculations button in Photoshop or the histogram? Who cares? You don't need to use that. Tell your story. And I say that as an educator also is because that's where I see most artists get bogged down in technology is they think they need to know the mechanics of every piece of technology. And they don't. Y'all don't know how your smartphone works, how it connects to the internet. You don't know. You know, you do Bluetooth or my laptop. I'm looking at my Apple right now. I don't know how that hard drive functions with the keyboard. I don't need to know that.
Hey, you don't even have to know what to call it.
Oh, go ahead, Mark.
No. I just was saying you don't even have to know what the names are.
I usually don't.
Go ahead.
Well, this is one of my favorite conversations that I have with my scientist colleagues when I'm sort of teaching folks how to talk about science with the general public. It's just about how little we do often know about the technological advances that make our lives work better. And yet we use them all the time, right? So whether that's our smartphone or convincing someone to get an x-ray, right? We convince very small children to get x-rays and we have no idea how x-rays work. And so the way that we do that is often by the benefits of the thing, right? How can you use this thing that makes your life better in some way? And I'm wondering, as you think about your work, what are some of the strategies, tools, or approaches that you have taken over the years that kind of help you not just do your work smarter, be more efficient, but have also kind of helped you to unlock some creative potential?
This is great. This is such a great question. And this falls squarely into photography as well as like imagining images in Photoshop, which is I have somehow given myself permission to change my mind about what the tool or function is and not have to be so reliant on a particular tool or function. And why that is for me. So photography, let's just talk about photography for a second. As I said, I'm a iPhone shooter only. I don't even own a different kind of camera. And it's because it's a dark room in my hand. Well, isn't that a crazy notion to think that your camera is your dark room? But that's what it is. And then because I could extrapolate to that, that my smartphone is my dark room. Oh, my laptop is my dark room. Oh, my iPad is my dark room. Oh, when I shoot, because I can shoot as if I'm already in the dark room, I can make anything out of any picture. I'm not limited by what I just see through the viewfinder. And I think that's given me this kind of freedom to explore because I'm not locked down to, oh, no, that Canon DS5, I used to use. I don't care. That doesn't matter anymore. And then with Photoshop, it's the same thing. Every 2 weeks, they're coming out with new developments in Photoshop, and they don't scare me. I will tell you, a lot of my colleagues who've probably been doing this as long as I have, I think many of them are scared because they haven't freed themselves yet, that they're not stuck with the old way. They're allowed to keep moving forward.
When you talk about that, that you keep using that word and that I used earlier too with you, that freedom, that you create this freedom. And I think that's at the essence of what it means to be an artist. Is being able to find, another word would be flow, right? That you would being in the flow at the moment, and you don't want other things like technology and other things to get in the way and block that flow.
And yet, what's interesting is that technology flow is something that I think I'm into, technology flow. And what I mean by that is I'm not afraid of the change. So think about, like, remember when paint tubes came out and the Impressionists started doing quick painting and they weren't doing these heavily gessoed, heavily mired oil painting time. It changed art, the whole art world completely. And I think digital, I know this is so grandiose of me to say, but I feel like the iPhone is doing that for photography. Kind of like the Brownie camera changed it for photography when the little Brownie camera came out. What was that, in the 1940s or 50s? Kodak came out with it. It opened up photography to everybody, not just the folks with the giant 4x5 or 8x10 cameras.
What's really amazing to me, Lisa, specifically when we talk about technologies like the iPhone, is that it really does free you in a way, because the technology that's on the back end of that, your little dark room in the phone, yes, you have to have a good composition pretty much. You still have to be in focus. You have those kinds of things that are hard to correct. But you honestly can almost do anything after that in post-processing with that, as long as there's some basics of that, which makes it a little more freeing, because you can just say, okay, maybe I didn't get the lighting exactly where I wanted it. I can go correct that.
100%. And I don't think that's a cheat. I think that's a marvel. It's revolutionary. Like, I do a lot of comparative work where I'll take there's an old photographer, old 1920s photographer, Ann Brigman. Love her work. I love the very 1920s style, out of focus. I have more digital or information, visual information in my smartphone than she had available to her with the lens qualities that she had in the film that she had back in the 20s. So, I mean, isn't that amazing? In this tiny little device that's in the palm of my hand. And yet I can still emulate her vibe or feeling or look So I could even take how do I want to say this? If you look at the resolution and fidelity and the crispness, for example, in an iPhone photo or any kind of smartphone photo, I can actually make it blurry and soft and romantic, like a soft lens. All while I'm shooting, like right there. Like, and let's not discount the time either. So I did a trip to Cuba and I was in on a photo trip, and most of the photographers are using large sensor cameras. You know, I'm developing and processing while I'm on a rickety cart in the middle of nowhere to see if I have the shot. So I know before I leave that location, I have what I want. Basically went to a dark room and got everything done. Whereas folks with a regular camera couldn't do that. I mean, that's freedom. That's technological flow, if you'd like.
I love that idea of technological flow. And I think that, again, when I think about the relationship between art and science, that's really that space in between, right? It's that, that opportunity to think differently, not just about our technology, but also our art, because we have different tools or we're using tools in new and different ways. So with that in mind, Lisa, are there things about your field that you're kind of looking forward to in terms of the way that the field maybe has changed recently or you see it changing in the near future?
That's a really interesting question. So I was in art school and photography school right when the digital revolution was first starting. So I hand-lined all my color film and processed everything, my black and white film, and digital was coming. And at that time, these kind of more dinosaur thinking old photographers were like, it's never going to take over. Film's never going to die. And those dudes were out of business within the next 5 years. And I mean, dead, gone, not physically dead, but commercially dead. And I feel like we're on the brink of that exact same thing, at least on the higher level imaging world, like photography world, where people laugh at me that I use a smartphone camera. They're like, you're not a real photographer. You don't know what you're doing. And I'm like, oh, my friends, it's where you get that, that uncomfortability that people have with change. So they get angry. You see it in the photo groups, you'll hear it in the comments. And I'm like, that's because change is coming and people are uncomfortable. So that's what I'm looking forward to, when we can get over that edge. And I'll say, I was interviewed for a magazine, a black and white photography magazine, and the guy who was interviewing kept calling it iPhonography. And I said, honey, can I interrupt you for a second? Because you don't call it Hasselblad photography. You don't call it Canon photography. You don't call it Nikon photography. Let's just talk about the work. And I'm looking forward to that day coming where we stop, right now with photography in particular, stop calling it the device. You know, because who cares how we made it? It's the wizard, not the wand.
That really summarizes that kind of idea very well with that phrase, because I think each time we've had a technological thing, and I know, Krista, you see this all the time in medicine too, that we have something comes along, we have some resistors to it. I'm not going to be able to go there. I just can't do it. I won't be the same professional. And then yet, it becomes more mainstream. And I was thinking back, you are absolutely right that I would go to an art show and the photographer go to great lengths to tell me they did it all in the camera. And this is before the camera could do anything else, right? I didn't care. In other words, if that's a crappy photograph, it's a crappy photograph. I don't care if you did it in there or if it doesn't appeal to me. You know what I mean? And so it was kind of like, that's great that you tell me, but you do, but I really don't. I want to talk about your painting. I want to know, or yeah. I want to talk about your photograph. I don't really care how you got there. Honest truth, I don't.
There's some interesting conversations. I mean, for some of those geeks, like Vermeer, did Vermeer use lenses or did he use a camera obscura? And was he projecting? Yeah, that's kind of interesting. But for the most part, that's not why we like Vermeer paintings. We like his paint. We like his work. How he got there is his business.
Yeah. And we go back and we try to, even when painting and art, we do the same thing, which is we try to, you know, to ding somebody. Oh, because later we may find out that they did something. We go, they cheated. You know, no, they didn't. They're making a work of art. They're using the tools that are available to them.
Yeah,
the best tools of the moment. And if it was a set of lenses to help me or something projected on the wall, which many of the old masters we now know did, you know, if they were doing that, that's not copying any different than anything else, because I can't do that painting.
Right.
It doesn't matter how much technology I have. I still can't paint like that.
Right. Or the story you're wanting, this is a visual story. So I'll give you an example. There's an amazing plugin for Photoshop called Flood. It's made by a company called Flaming Pear. It makes the most amazing bodies of water. I mean, just crazy. I use it all the time in my composites. And someone, a senior finisher who does what I do, is like, you're a hack for using that. And I said, well, yeah, I can compose that in Photoshop with photos and brushes and take hours, but why wouldn't I click a button that does it in 35 seconds? That's just like, why? Who cares how I got there? It's that I knew to go there. If that makes the destination, I knew the visual destination.
And the product was as good as if you had spent hours doing it. So why would I do that when it's a job to do that? I can get, if somebody wants to go back and shoot 35 millimeter film and they want to shoot an old camera, I get that. If they want to do it for their own nostalgia and their own feeling of it, but don't tell me that that's better than, you know, something that's in digital.
Right.
And that's where we get into this difference.
Well, I'm glad you mentioned that too. I have a class on Creative Live on black and white photography. And I talk about this in mobile photography, mobile digital photography, whatever you want to call it. And I talk about Ansel Adams' zone system in there. You still use the Ansel Adams zone system. We're just talking about it in digital numbers, not it's a different scale than the Ansel Adams scale, which is just numbers. I talk about film grain. So there used to be Tri-X 3200. It was like this rock and roll film grain, like super contrasty, golf ball size grain, not a lot of midtones. And I talk about that. Wow, if that's the look you want, or if you want a Polypan look or a T-Max 25 or 125 speed film that's got a very fine grain, great. When you're shooting digital, make the grain small. When you're shooting digital, process it with a great big grain, because you have that ability. It's just that I know that the big contrasty grain with little midtone, that looks like rock and roll 1970s film. Okay. You don't care how I got there, right? You don't care that I did it in a slider in Lightroom. No.
So are there things that you can't reproduce that you wish that you could from a digital standpoint?
Yes, I wish that they had digital printers that printed with paint.
Ooh, yes.
Wouldn't that be amazing? I've been talking to a guy at Adobe about this. Like, wouldn't that be amazing if we could actually have a 3D printer paint with real paint? I would like that.
What about that? Say more about what's so attractive about that.
Well, okay, I'm going to be honest here. I'm going to admit I'm a failed painter because I'm a lousy renderer. And I like the idea of a printer starting a painting for me with real paint. And then maybe I can manipulate on top of that. That could be interesting. But I also think that I can remember the first time I saw Van Gogh in person. Like, I remember seeing Van Gogh's printed pieces in school and studying art history and going, it's all right. And then going to Amsterdam and going, Oh, because I saw it in real life. So that's a technological breakthrough I would love to see happen, because I bet it would change everything for me.
Yeah, and it would bring texture in.
Yeah,
which is texture and depth. We simulate texture and depth as a photographer. And we do even as a 2D painter, if you're just doing it like with pencils or markers. But I agree with you. When you go, and if you can get close enough, sometimes you can't.
Yeah, you get in trouble.
But if you can get close enough to really see, you can see the brush marks, and you can see what's on top, where maybe even the artist went back in and retouched, put something on top of it. I'm just blown away by that.
Yeah.
So I agree with you. I mean, if a printer could really put out a painting for me that's got that kind of 3D, which I don't know why we're that far away from it, because we got 3D.
Oh, maybe we're not. We might not be.
But maybe somebody hasn't really made that link yet.
Yeah.
To connect the two.
But maybe one of your listeners will contact me and say, already got this.
I've already got it. That's great. Just a reminder that the Da Vinci Pursuit brings together artists and scientists and members of the community to engage in conversations that explore the intersections between art and science. And we encourage you to explore further some of what we're talking about today, to try some things on your own, to have conversations with other individuals, and we'll be right back.
No alarm clock. No traffic to negotiate. No staff meetings to attend. Sunday is your day, so do yourself a favor. Tune out all that noise and tune in for Sunday Baroque.
Sunday morning from 5 to 9 here on 88.7 WICR.
Welcome back. We're having a conversation with Lisa Carney about keeping focused. She has coined the phrase, "It's not the wand, it's the wizard," as a way of describing the relationship of her art and technology in her work. One of the things, Lisa, that really intrigues me about your work is the way that you encourage folks to try new things with their mobile devices from a photography standpoint. And I will share with you, I was an undergraduate major in broadcasting. So I have a little bit of training that I just don't use anymore. I joke with Mark that I was one of those students that actually learned to physically cut tape when I was doing audio, but then also learned nonlinear editing. And it's a part of my brain that I don't use very much anymore, if I'm honest. I'm a busy researcher now. So if I wanted to kind of get started, like sort of think about what I could do with the amazing technology that I know lives in this little tiny device in my pocket every day, where might be a good place to start?
Well, this is a really good question. And this is so near and dear to my heart because I'm really into advocating using smartphones creatively and for legitimate, if you will, art. I will tell you, there is so much you can do in this phone. I have some classes on a platform called Creative Live. Like when I really changed my mind about the smartphone was when I started doing day for night. Do you remember like in the old Perry Mason and 1970s TV shows, they shot in the daytime. Alfred Hitchcock used to do this too and made it look like night. I started doing that on my phone. I was like, hey, wait a minute. Cause I'll be honest. I go to bed really early and I get up at the crack of Jesus in the morning and I don't want to be out in the forest at night by myself shooting. I just know there's bears. So I'm really trying to encourage people to experiment with that kind of thing. Like what if you're walking in the forest and like, ooh, how would I make this nighttime? Oh, well, you know, there's a program by Adobe called Lightroom and you get it for free on your phone and you could do crazy stuff like that. And if any of your listeners are interested, I have a whole coursework on experimental photography on your mobile phone through Creative Live or day for night. And why I suggest this is if you do something crazy and extreme like that, it kind of changes your brain and how you think about the device. And it doesn't mean you're going to be a day for night shooter, but then all of a sudden, all these other possibilities open up and you're like, oh, wait a minute, I can make a graphic background or, oh, wait a minute, I can make a comic book graphic novel on my phone. Like I did a whole series on COVID after I got my vaccine. Things were a little weird the day I got my vaccine, like the first vaccine, and things looked weird, different, like colors. I did a whole photo series on it. Like, oh, what does my brain look like on a vaccine? You know, and it was a way of relieving my anxiety about what was going on because I got to express it visually for myself and just go, oh, yeah, things look different. Things are weird right now. And so I'm all about experimentation and trying to do that. And I'll tell you another great way of doing that is illustrate a story. Like what I mean by that is, so one of the better pieces or bodies of work I've recently produced was after a really hard breakup, a relationship and I broke up and then COVID happened and all sorts of things happened. And I did a series on grief. So I just wanted to illustrate what grief felt like to me. And it's such a great way of freeing yourself to look at just the story you want to tell, not necessarily what is the picture. What is the technique behind the picture? But what are you trying to express feeling wise? And that's a great way to get into it, especially if you do it all on your phone.
One of the reasons why I love that approach is that it does make it about sort of the crisis of imagination that you have,
that's
not about
phrase.
The technology, right? Because that knows how to use Photoshop, I will say, like, I know just enough to be dangerous, right? So I go in and I feel often overwhelmed by all of the options. And the idea of sort of binding your thinking a little bit. One of my favorite researchers is Keith Sawyer. I don't know if you know his work. Keith is a PhD educator by training. And his sabbatical a number of years ago was this project called Group Genius, where he went to some of the most creative organizations in the world. So he spent time at SCAD, at 3M, at Google, to kind of find out what made teams creative. And what he found was that a little bit of constraint can often make you even more creative, right? Just saying, shoot anything, right? It, you know, you end up not necessarily being very, very creative, but I love that idea of saying like, choose a story and then focus on the images, not necessarily on the technology. And then later, as you get more comfortable, you can add those pieces back in. That to me actually feels quite freeing.
I will tell you, you've nailed it. That is 100% my experience throughout my entire visual career, as I'd like to call it, is the binding makes it more subject driven and you can focus on the story. And then I do technology exercises. I don't know if that's the right way to say it, but for example, like I mentioned, Ann Brigman's work or Fan Ho, who's an amazing photographer. I'll take Fan Ho's photo and go, great, how would I reproduce that on the computer with nothing? Like I have nothing. I'm starting from scratch. How could I make something that looks like that? And that's where I learned the technology, because I'm doing an exercise. I'm not creating my vision. I'm trying to mimic someone else's vision. And then when it comes time to tell my own story, those tools, I don't even have to think about them. They just pop up effortlessly. Because it's kind of a left brain, right brain thing, isn't it? It's learning. I call it technological learning, you know, like Photoshop, you're going to learn the technology. And then there's creative. And they are not the same. They are completely separate.
It makes me think about an education theory that I spend a lot of time talking about Dreyfus's model of skill acquisition. So his model sort of looks at how experts think differently than novices. And I love this question, right? How do experts think and behave differently than novices do? It's super helpful if you're an expert and you're trying to explain something to a novice, you figure out like, oh, right, this is why this feels like second nature to me. This is how I can make my thinking visible. And your question about technology is a good one, right? Because in a lot of ways, you need to be in a space where you have a series of steps to follow, right? That sort of novice mind to learn the technology. And the artistic piece is your vision, right? It's really complicated in your head. It is the, you know, it's the feelings and the emotions and the connections that you want to portray in a particular image. And so that piece is super, you're an expert in your own art, right? You're not an expert in the technology. And so thinking about kind of how do experts sound different than novices? We know that, for example, novices really feel comforted by having a set of steps to follow, but experts find that set of steps super annoying, right? And I'm sure that you can experience that, you know, as you get better at using a particular technology, you don't want to follow those steps in order every single time. So that's really interesting to hear you talk about.
You actually just explained something, why I don't teach beginning courses anymore. And I couldn't figure out why I hate doing them. And it's because I'm so far removed from the beginning process of Photoshop that I feel like I can't be in service of anyone for it, because I can't remember, oh yeah, do I have to tell you to click that button? Oh, do I have to tell you how to hold the pen? Oh, I'm so sorry. It didn't even occur to me that I have to tell you that now. That's brilliant. I find that to be very accurate.
Yeah, Dreyfus's model of skill acquisition. And it is super helpful. Mark knows I spend a fair amount of time, you know, teaching, for example, surgeons how to work with very young medical students. It's like teaching someone how to drive a car if you drive, right? It becomes second nature to you that you know how frustrating it is to sit next to someone who's learning how to drive for the first time. So
I just did that with my high schooler. Yes.
So you know that.
Yes, I know that viscerally. Yes.
Absolutely.
What I was going to ask you or talk about with you was this. I like this idea of a way of entering for somebody in our audience is that idea of going into being able to say, what story would I like to tell? I think there's something magical about saying, let's say my dad is older and I could think about what images might I want to capture that would tell the story of my dad? And that all of a sudden launches me into a different way of looking at photography.
Yeah. And I have to say, I think it's imperative. I think it's imperative that is the conversation for creatives who are creating, that is what you are talking about. You are not talking about your gear. You're not talking, oh, I use a Winsor Newton Sable paintbrush and I'm using acrylic, whatever. No one gives a shit about any of that. Sorry. It's the story. And I wish for all of us out there, if we could be more introspective about that, because that's what's interesting. I got to be honest, I'm not really interested in looking at one more sunset bridge sailboat picture with a ballerina on it. I don't care, but show me what you feel about your mama as she's dying. I want to see that. Or how you feel about the grief of what our country's going through with our division and really pulling apart. Let's look at that. Wouldn't that be more interesting? Harder, maybe.
Harder,
but more interesting.
But it is more interesting. And it is that idea of being able to tell story. I'm thinking back to one of the other courses that I took, and one of it was doing iPhone photography with toys. And yes, it all of a sudden, but toys in situations, right? And in positions, and you can fake out everybody with making that toy look like it's really in there, right?
Yeah.
But I was thinking, wow, if you were also somebody, why don't you try to write a book with photography for a child? And you don't have to be a great writer, but why don't you tell the story through pictures of a character or a couple characters that you don't have to imagine? They're toys, but imagine where they might be and where are they going?
Yeah. Yeah. And I'll tell you, that's one of the things about this technology that I love is the accessibility and immediacy. So I will tell you, my son has the most beautiful framing. Like when he shoots graphically, and it's natural, he just has it. And his vision was always so amazing. And what if you introduce that to our children? Like, hey, you scared at school? What does it feel like being scared at school? What does this time look like? Why don't we take some pictures of what does that look like? Or grandma's dying. This is hard. What are you feeling? Let's go take some pictures and talk about that. That's what's interesting. That's what's moving. That's what's, I know, transcendental, I would say. That's what really transforms us and our relationships.
Yeah. And it doesn't even have to be, and that's what you're saying, you're helping me make a leap here. It doesn't even have to be images of that, what you're seeing. It can be images of that, what you're feeling.
Yeah. Right? I mean, what if death is a leap?
You want it to be, right?
Yes. Yes. Like I have I did in that macro class that I think you saw on Kelby One.
Yes.
I have the old is gold section, and it's all these old, like old leaves, trash, old dried up stuff. And it's because I was going through this really hard period where I'm like, Jesus, I am old. My neck is crinkly. Oh my God, I'm getting old. And it looks like I just took pretty pictures of old things, but no, I was walking out and looking at, oh my gosh, things are beautiful. Even when they're old, maybe I'm beautiful when I'm old. No one else knows that's what the backstory was.
No, but I love, no,
I know.
No, but however, when I, you know, and I do remember that segment that you did, and I was blown away because I had never thought to look at it that way. Mm. In other words, and then you did one also, which I thought was really another way that somebody could enter into this. And that was something that had holes in it. And then you were sometimes focused at the level of, this was a leaf, sometimes focused at the level of leaf, but sometimes you focus back behind it and it was what was through the holes. And I just had never ever thought to use an old leaf that was falling apart in the way you did that.
Well, and I'll tell you, that was right when I was at the beginning of that horrible breakup and I was just a wreck. And isn't that interesting that I can go out and I have a commitment to myself and I shoot pictures every single day. Every single day I take a picture. And I was like, God, I just feel like an old bag full of holes. And yeah, that's what I shot. Yeah, it's fun, isn't it? I mean, it's I don't know. That's why I guess they call it art therapy, right?
Yeah, and isn't a way it is. I want to thank you so much,
oh, sorry, Lisa. Mark, go ahead.
So much for being with us and taking us on this journey. It was more than behind the scenes in the photographic process. It was really taking us on a journey of the artistic process and the role of technology and science put in a proper perspective. It's important. It's there. But you really transcended all of that. And I want to thank you so much.
No, well, thank you very much. This, as I said, this was a hoot. It was fun.
Good.
Until next time, I'm Krista Longton, reminding you to tune in again where we explore more curiosities from the intersections of art and science. Thanks, Lisa.
You've been listening to Intersections, where art and science meet, with your host, Mark Kiesling, the founder of the Da Vinci Pursuit, and Krista Hoffman Longton, Assistant Dean for Faculty Affairs and Professional Development at the Indiana University School of Medicine. Just a reminder, the Da Vinci Pursuit brings together artists, scientists, and members of the community to engage in conversation that explore the intersections between art and science. We encourage you to explore further in conversation with others. Any of the ideas explored in today's show at www.thedaVinciPursuit.com.